Okay, two questions. That's good. Yesterday, you said something about that a fly doesn't take up more or less of consciousness than something bigger. That is space thinking, and Atma is not limited by space. Can you please explain more, please? Okay. What I was saying is that there's two orders of reality. You're the self, which is not subject to time or space. In fact, from the self, with the Maya, the time, space comes into manifestation, kind of like your imagination. Like if you have an imagination, it comes into manifestation from yourself. But in that manifestation includes space itself. And then all of the objects are within space, but space, air, fire, water, earth are the elements, and then everything else is what we call an elemental of those in terms of the names and forms. And so if space is, if the Atma does not, if yourself does not exist as an object in space, right, because space comes into manifestation, like in your imagination, space, air, fire, water, earth come into manifestation. That means space, the Atma can't have a size, right? Because any object takes up space, right? Like there's a right side and a left side, a top. And so say there is no space from the standpoint of yourself, then there is no size, nor is there room for a second thing, because you need space to have a second thing. Right, and so say if the Atma yourself as conscious being is free of space and does not exist as an object within space, then it basically has no dimension, and it has no spatial dimension because it's free of space. And so that means yourself is neither big nor large, or none of these words are qualifiers or adjectives for your nature, the nature of the self. But that doesn't mean the self is small or large. It means it's non-dual. There's not room for a second thing, and the universe that comes into manifestation and goes into unmanifest condition is mitya. Mitya means it doesn't have any existence to compete with the self. So in reality, the only thing there is the self, and the self isn't big or small or anything because it's free from space. So what that means is that everything that exists within the creation enjoys the same non-dual self that doesn't have a right side or a left side or an up or down, but is just simply non-dual. So there's not a question of you or me or the mosquito, you know, or any size being, including Ishwara. There's no question of it having more or less self-experience. You know, like we can say Ishwara's upadhi is infinite. So you can say he includes all of space, infinite space. And so then wouldn't his experience of the Atma, of the self, which is Brahman, be a bigger experience than my experience or the mosquito's experience? And the answer is no, because the self doesn't expand or contract, you know, in relationship to the mitya upadhi that comes and goes. So if even the mitya upadhi of Ishwara or of the mosquito enjoys the same non-dual space, non-dual self that is not spatial. It simply is non-dual. And so how can you experience a part of what is non-dual? Because there's no division there. And so your self-experience is only one non-dual self-experience, which is exactly the same for all beings and for Ishwara, for all the jivas, and of course the mosquitoes and the fish and the animals and the reptiles and the birds and the butterflies and all the worms underground, all living creatures, you know, that have a sukshma sharira, subtle body, have that same total, that same self experience. Now when I say that, there's something misleading there. The self experience belongs only to the self. And so the upadhi, see, if I get rid of the whole universe, the self experience of me, this me, that is me, the self that is me, that we have me, this word, me, is labels me, okay? The word me or I label is just a label for my own self, the fact of the word. You know, it's called the padartha, the actual thing which the word is labeling. So that self-experience, with or without the universe, is there. And so now say this non-dual self-experience is the sukshma sharira of the mosquito, right, reflects that and says, I am a mosquito. Right? So what it reflects, this, it doesn't reflect the self-experience. The self-experience is the nature of the self, but then the mosquito is known, right? And so it's the knownness in the mosquito is the consciousness in the mosquito. And so from its own standpoint, it takes itself to be very tiny because the upadhi is very tiny, you know. But itself is neither tiny nor big. It's not spatial. So Ishwara says, oh, my upadhi is infinite, you know. But the self-experience, the me experience for Ishwara is exactly the same because it's not spatial. So there's no difference between the mosquito's self-experience or your self-experience or the bear's self-experience. It makes no difference because the self-experience is the nature of the self. Right? So there's only one self-experience. The size of the upadhi doesn't matter, but then you take yourself to be, you take the, you, the upadhi takes itself to be the self. And so then it's a little tiny self, because it's measuring the self by the size of the upadhi. But the self itself doesn't have any size. It's not big or small. It simply is non-dual. It's really, to really understand the kind of the beauty of this and have it not seem like, well, how can it be there then? It's just like in contemplation, just to be with yourself, as your own me experience, your own self experience, not as an object, but just be yourself. And then let your buddhi ask, what size am I? You know, these kind of, what size am I? Am I big? Am I small? And what happens is that these questions just kind of fall to the ground because they just don't apply to yourself. You're not a size. You're not big or small. You simply are. Your being simply is. And then you say, well, I should be big. Then try to find some way to measure that bigness. That if there's any sense of bigness, it's the fact that you are non-dual, you know. If there's nothing border, there are no borders. But there's also no size. There's no borders, there's no size. There's nothing outside of you, and yet there's no size. So to really understand what that means, you have to kind of have those words, point those words at your own experience when you're kind of just focusing on your being. And you say, what size am I? These words fall off. They don't mean anything. Am I any particular color? All of these, you know, any particular quality, they simply don't apply. So the mosquito and you are exactly the same. same self experience, which is not given to you by the upadhi. It's the very nature of you is the nature as consciousness. That's who you are. So that's where the me experience is just the nature of consciousness itself. So the whole universe goes away and you still are. And that's your experience. I still am. Nothing has happened to me. The best way to understand that is waking up from a dream, which is so real. When you're in the dream, when you wake up from the dream, you realize I still am. Nothing has happened to me. You know? But that whole dream that was your reality for those moments that it was there is totally gone, and everything that you had taken to be real and taken to be yourself is totally gone, and not one thing has happened to you, not even a whisper, not the slightest whisper of anything is happening to you. And that's the reality in reference to this universe also. And in reference to the death experience is that there is no death experience. There's certainly a change of scenery. You're moving on, but if you're not moving on, the Sukshma Sharira is not moving on into any unknown territory because you've done it from beginningless time. When you come into a fresh physical upadhi, those memories are supposed to be kind of thwarted and blocked, like paribandhakas. Some obstructions are there for, in terms of the memory banks of all of your prior experiences. For some people, I mean, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that some little children remember all their experiences. Not all of the experiences, but they have a clear recollection of where they lived and who their parents were, and they want to go find their parents. And there's many instances where they do that. It's documented, you know, which makes sense to me. It's just that the closure didn't take place as it normally does. So there's some memory there, you know. I think especially when there's some trauma in that death experience, at least from two or three instances that you can find on YouTube, but they've been made the rounds quite a bit, and there's some research that has been done, anecdotal research, which means that you can't prove it, but the research looks at all of these various cases, individual cases, where there's a lot of evidence that whatever the child is reporting, and in one case, actually an adult, but started in childhood, is reporting. There's a lot of evidence that the experiences and memories they were having were valid. They researched it and they could find exactly what the family that now adult used to belong to. Some old mother, very old mother, was still alive. That's interesting. Very interesting research that is done on given experiences that are there. So it's called anecdotal evidence. It means you can't prove it, really. You just have examples that make a good case for it. So much for the mosquito. Before I came to Vedanta, I thought that consciousness was something that came from the brain in waking state, and that it was not present in deep sleep. Is there a logic explanation how it cannot be that like that? Before I came to Vedanta, I thought that consciousness was something that came from the brain in the waking state, and that it was not present in deep sleep. Is there a logical explanation? Is there how it cannot be like that? Oh, I think I understand. Maybe. I think there are different explanations that in the Vedanta that come together in many different ways to negate the possibility of that not being so. If that's what the question is. The negate the possibility of it not being so means that that consciousness itself must be there, no matter what the experience is, because consciousness is the adhishtana of all experience. And so once you can establish, so there's just, what I'm saying is that there's so different avenues to establish this. But one is the adhishtana and the mithya, the relationship between what is the adhishtana and what is mithya. So just to remind you, what is mithya, what classifies as mithya is anything that is not timeless, really. Because if it's not free from time, it has a beginning and an end. If it has a beginning and end, it depends upon something else for its being. And when we analyze the creation, saying, well, you know, like in the wooden desk, of course, the mithya desk depends upon the wood. So the wood is the adhishtana of the desk. That is true. And that's why we can use an example like that. Yeah, that the wood is the adhishtana of the desk within the confines of that particular relationship, wood desk, satya mithya relationship. And, but it doesn't, the problem is that the wood also needs an adhishtana. Because as we analyze the wood, we find that there is no such thing as just like wood. It's not just wood. Wood itself is made of many, many different particles. And it breaks down into atoms, it breaks down into quarks. You cannot find actually a thing there. You find that everything in the universe is a conglomerate. And every part of that conglomerate comes into being and goes out of being. So to find the adhishtana within the creation, first of all, you can't find a thing in the creation to be an adhishtana of anything. You can't even find a thing because everything that you say is a thing is a conglomerate made up of smaller things and smaller things and smaller things and smaller things. So what do those smaller things and smaller things and smaller things depend upon? You know, in the end, you have to take off the rupa, you have to take off the form, finally, you've got to take off the form in order to find the adhishtana. What is the truth of the form? What's holding the form? What's the substance of the form? But if you take off the substance of the form, and this is only going to be one form among an infinite number of conglomerates, you know, smaller and smaller, smaller forms, you have to take off the form to see what the substance is. And you can't define the substance by another form, because then again, you don't know what that form is dependent on for its being. And so it gets down to, if you take off the form, ultimately you just take off the form. Okay, we've taken off the form. Now you can't see. Now there's nothing there for you to experience. And so what is left, really, is just the being that is always there, starting with a bigger conglomerate to down, 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 for smaller, 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 finally. Just take off the form and see what's there, and that is the adhishtana. But the only thing that is there that is not leaving and is there from the top to the bottom is existence or being itself. And that has no form. Okay, so now we say that that existence is consciousness. There's a lot of, not knower, but consciousness. Because consciousness itself also is not objectifiable. And consciousness also in every experience, even when I'm taking the, you know, down to molecules and quarks and whatnot, what is there always, no matter what I'm doing, is the sat-chit, is conscious being. Not consciousness of something, but just known, it isness and knownness. That is the common denominator of all things. So what if you think of consciousness itself as knownness? Isness and knownness, because within the creation, it is, it is, it is, it is known, it is known, it is known, and I say, I am the knower. This is the known, I am the knower. But now we have the knower-known dichotomy, and then we realize, well, experientially, there is no knower, so there's only the known. There's the consciousness, there's consciousness, which is the isness, the set, and the chit. That is what is here as the common denominator of everything. And so now, when the antakarana is in deep sleep, means it's gone into its causal condition, what is its adhishtana? Right. Because the causal condition for the any jiva, it comes into being and goes out of being along with the jiva upadhi. Yeah. And then it's, because it's a jnanam, if we get right to the causal condition, its nature, ignorance is beginningless, but it comes to an end. That's the unique quality of ignorance. But ignorance, you say, well, when did the ignorance begin? You know, what, say somebody walks into the room that you've never seen them before. Okay? You're positive. You walk into the room, and you're, and then what happens? You become aware now that you've never seen them before. But when did that ignorance begin of anything? It had no beginning. It comes to an end, right? It comes to an end with your knowledge, but it had no beginning, you know. And so ajnanam and that causal condition of anything is still within maya, you know. And so the being, the sat-chit, the being which is consciousness itself, is its adhishtana. So there's no possibility of that particular situation where the sattva mind goes into its causal condition of not having as its basis sat-chit, conscious being, as does absolutely everything else. But now the thing is, in this case, what is going into its causal condition is the sattva mind. And so when I say sattva because sattva is what allows for the manifestation of consciousness. So now when the sattva mind comes back into full form in the waking state, then that deep sleep experience in which there is no subject-object differentiation, there's no duality, there's no vaichitriya, this display of duality, of differentiation, that's not there in the deep sleep. It's nirvikalpa. There's no subject-object differentiation at all. You know, so it's just pure ajnanam. So that pure ajnanam, which is causal to the sukshma sharira and to the stula sharira for that matter, but here, in terms of deep sleep, it's the antakaran, it's the mind and the sense organs that go into unmanifest causal condition. They come back. Okay? Now, when they come back, what is the relationship that you have now as the jiva upadhi? What is the relationship you have with that deep sleep experience? You remember it. It's just a memory. You can talk about it. When I was asleep, it was like this. But why shouldn't it be a memory? You're here, you went to sleep, and now you've come back. And when you were asleep, your sense organs and mind are in causal condition. So they're not functioning. So when you come back and your mind is functioning, you can say, when I was asleep, there was no subject-object relationship. It was completely nirvikalpa without any subject-object differentiation. I didn't know anything. I slept well. I was your sleep. Well, mine was great too. Okay, so we remember this condition, you know. And how can, now one other little jump here. You remember this condition. You remember the condition of the dream state. You remember yesterday's waking state. You know, you have lots of memories. Anything in the past, any person you've met, when you see them again, you remember them, right? Because there was a vritti there. If you had a vritti, when the vritti passes, it goes into the memory banks. If your memory is good, you know, like mine's not that good anymore, but nevertheless, I do still have some memory, so I can attest to the fact that, you know, I remember this that happened. I remember this that happened. I remember my waking states that happened. I remember my dream states that happened. I remember my deep sleep states that happened. They're just states of experience. And so it's all about memory, you know. That's how the Shastra works with it. And that's what's sensible, actually. And those are some of the major logics that we use for establishing that. And again, it's Shruti, Yukti, Anubhava. Deep sleep experiences there, you know. Then you have to have some means for accounting for that experience. You have to have some logic for it. And you have to have a pramana for it. So that is all there. So. Anybody have anything? Any questions? Anything?
Yeah. What is the how would you call it, the mechanics or the psychodynamic by which we tend to internalize other people suffering or reactions or misbehavior? Why does it happen? And on the other side, how can you become more objective, like being there to listen, and if you are asked to be there to help.
You know, it does seem like we, like Satin, somebody hurts us, or we have hurt them, or there's some sort of pain that we say is, we internalize that pain. It's like we take that person inside, or that suffering inside, or say between two of you, there's something painful that has happened between the two of you, and there's bad feelings or whatever, and then you tend to really take that inside, and so you're walking around with it now. Is in turn, we say, you've internalized. Swamiji used to say, keep everybody outside, don't take them inside, you know. But what we can say about that psychologically is that usually the very painful dynamic that takes place is that painful because the pain is already inside, and the relationship and the hurt in the relationship triggers that pain that is inside. And then the person and the pain are put together. You know? So we often will just think that this pain is a fresh pain that comes up because of the hurt or whatever that is going on between the two of us. And that could be true, but when that happens, that taking it so deeply inside doesn't usually happen. When it goes so deeply inside, it means that the pain is already there, and now this person who's triggered it is attached to that pain. And so they take the form of that pain, in a sense. So that's often what happens, which is a little different than what Swamiji is talking about. But the fact is when the pain is kind of the unbearable pain, that unbearable pain is usually something that was gained in childhood, and you're walking around with it, and then other people in the world are triggering it. Say that type of pain is not there in the unconscious, then that's not being triggered, that kind of heartbreaking pain that only a little child can have, these huge pains. They have huge, huge pains because they're these little tiny creatures, little tiny beings among all these giants, you know. So the pain is so, so big for their little bodies. You can see them, like when their hurt feelings are hurt or they're crying or something like that. It's like the whole body is racked in that pain. So we have a lot of pain inside of us. That's why some doing this work, we have to keep doing it and work on those things. And then the internalized pain is not as intense because of that, because we've done that work. And so when that's projected, that big pain is projected out onto another person, then that pain that is already there takes the form of that person. And then you're carrying the pain in the form of that person around inside. So that's normally, that's often what the case is, you know. Otherwise, you have more objectivity at your disposal in being able to actually keep the person outside and to deal with the feelings and the pain and to be helpful to that person and to yourself. You have the space to do that. But when there's a big pain that is triggered by that reaction already inside, then the person now is identified with that pain, which is internal. And so to keep that person outside of you, you have to keep that pain outside of you, because the two have come together. And so then you can do work on yourself, like my famous saying is, okay, what is this really about? What is really hurting you? What is making this so, so very painful, you know? And also, another thing, this is a different way of using imagination, is to ask yourself to imagine. We've done this, but there's just different ways of using the same thing. Like to ask yourself, just to imagine what I had really wanted to happen, what I was really looking for, what I was really hoping for in terms of this relationship, and say, and just imagine it, you know. And then that imagination is often very much connected to that original pain. But the story, it's the adult story, but you can see what the healing was needed for that original pain. So I think it's really helpful, especially when you say, what is that really about, you know? And when you have an imagination of what you would really have liked, it's kind of usually an archetypal fantasy of sorts. I don't mean fantasy in a derogatory way. It's just that humans want certain things to be a certain way because that's the archetype, that's the blueprint of what is supposed to happen to a human being as they go through life. The relationship with the parents, the relationship with the siblings, the meeting of their loved one, the getting married, the having children. There's all of these archetypal events, including the marriage and then the having the children, the naming of the children, you know, and then there's just archetypal moments throughout the lifetime that are developmental. And we all go through it, and there are all of these different rituals and things in all the various cultures that celebrate these type of things. But sometimes in these first years, there's archetypal developments that need to happen, you know, for this inner self, for the inner self structure. I mean, that not the Atma, but the internal structure to be really secure and have a natural sense of self-worth and of being loved. In this era, that's pretty hard to get that. And if you have parents that were able to give that to you, that's such a blessing. Because most of us were not even good parents who are fine people, dharmic people, they're not necessarily able to give that amount of love and care and time with, being with, for the child to get filled up like that. You know, they're also tired and irritable and exhausted and all these things. And so the child doesn't get these things that are necessary for you to have that self-structure where you feel whole and complete and full, you know. It's a big thing. If you have that, that's really a wonderful, wonderful thing. But it's not that common. What is more common is to have, you know, be a little wobbly in that area. Not to really feel loved, not to really feel wanted on a deep level. That you don't feel loved, you don't feel wanted, you don't feel have self-worth. All these are the magic words of our era, you know. They're the hurt or the disease of our era. So these things get triggered in a relationship. They're so deep, you know. And then the hurt is so much. It's buried nicely in your unconscious. But when you start to go in there and dig these things up, or if somebody who's been in a way like your savior, making you feel wanted and loved and cared for, and then they back off in one way or another, the relationship doesn't work out. There can be leave a huge hole inside because they were covering up the hole. You know? So these things we have to understand and then learn how to be with the ones, to support little ones inside, to fill them up with love. Like we have to do that. That Bhagavan gave us that gift, that when we didn't get filled up properly when we were young, we can do it ourselves and fill it up in that imaginal realm, the realm of the... Imaginal realm is the realm of the unconscious. I don't know if that helps, but it's just kind of getting down to the core of the problem, even of trying to keep people, a person who's really hurt you, to be able to keep them outside. You know? And then to help them is a whole other issue, because if the relationship has been very hurtful, then how can you really help them? You can, but what I'm saying is, how can you really help them when you're no longer with them and you've taken away that security that they had found through you? Yeah. So you can be a good listener, and you can be a person who becomes a good friend who doesn't run away. I mean, on either side of the relationship, you can do that, and that is helpful. But still, there's a tremendous hurt when the relationship is severed, because it filled up a very deep part of yourself, if that's the case, which it is more often than not. Not always, but... Does that make any sense? Yeah.
So is that the same, like... Because some people say that they feel some other people's pain. I mean, you can express it like that.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that really that the other person is triggering what's already inside me?
Often, but yeah. there also is the other, that when two of you are very connected karmically, it's a little woo-woo-ish, but if there's some karmically connected or deeply connected emotionally with each other, then if that person is thinking or feeling something often, and they can be on the other side of the world, you can often feel it. You can like feel their presence. And you don't feel that that's coming from you. You feel it's coming to you.
Mm.
And that's also possible. Mm. And it's not for sure, but you can suspect that, and it feels that way, and you kind of can be relatively certain that that connection is there, and that person, especially if it's a relationship, even a friendship that has gone bad where there was an emotional connection, and then there's hurt involved or anger involved, when that person's directing that hurt or anger at you, even when they're on the other side of the world, because the psyche doesn't have much, it's not time-bound like that, then you can feel it. I had some experiences like that, not recently, when I was younger. And it was such a weird thing, but it really seemed like that was happening. And, but I didn't know for sure, I just thought so. And I asked Swamiji about it. I said, is it possible that these feelings are coming at me, but they're not mine, because they feel like they're coming from this person, not from me? Could that be possible? You know? And he said, yes, that's possible. And I said, well, what do I do if that's the truth in that situation? You know, what do I do? He said, you just pray for them and ask them to go back to their own place with love. You send them back with love, just mentally. So that's what I would do. And I can't prove that. I don't know for sure. But that's how it, when it's a little strange thing like that, and it's not something that you can really own, but you know that there's a connection, which is a hurtful connection. There can be a love connection too, and then you also can feel. It's just that you have to realize that because I don't like the woo-woo-ness of it, you know. But the fact is that Hiranyagarbha, the subtle plane, we're all completely connected, just like we're all connected by these laws. We're all connected here. You know, on this plane, you know, by all of the different laws that hold this together as one entity, but Hiranyagarbha also, we're all connected by a set of laws. And we all have experiences of one sort or another that shows certain synchronicities where you were thinking about somebody and then they call. Just little things like this. Or you're feeling, you know, something from someone. And then that turns out to be the truth if you research it with that person. There's just all these kind of things. And I don't pay much attention to all of that, but when there was some difficult situations that I found myself in, you know, I felt a lot of negative stuff coming toward me, and I didn't think it was coming out of me. I felt like it was coming to me, like that. That's when I asked Swamiji, is that possible, or am I just making this up, you know? And he said, no, it's possible, and this is what you should do.
What perception are we using when that happens?
It's more feeling, it's internal, like coming into your mind, not through your eyes or through your sense organs.
So it's the mind. the psyche.
Yeah. I don't know very much about it. There are a lot of people who have done a lot of work and a lot of practice with psychic type communications and things like that. I haven't done that, but I think all of us, whether you've done that work or not, or you've had plenty of experiences, you know, that are more of synchronistic, not experiences that are explained by the laws in this dimension. They're experiences that take place in another dimension, in more of the subtle dimension. And most of us don't pay much attention to it, and some people devote a lot of attention to that and developing that, but whether you devote attention to it or not, you still have a good enough number of experiences to know that there is a synchronous causal field that's different than the causal field that we have here. Like, for instance, an obvious synchronicity that Swamiji sometimes talks about is just how can we do rituals and offer prayers into the fire so that it'll rain and then it starts raining. Or we do rituals and chants and prayers, you know, for somebody to have a child, get pregnant. And then we do those and the person gets pregnant. You know, there's lots of examples. Those are like synchronicities, you know, where something, some other dimension is being invoked. The laws of another dimension, not this one. You know, for this one, like if we wanted to rain, we'd be probably seeding the clouds or something. We wouldn't be praying to Bhagawan to ask for rain. So that is dealing with some other dimension of laws. And similarly with where you, there's communication that takes place between you and another person, but not, you're on the other side of the world. But that communication takes place. Those are those kind of uncanny things. And they're only uncanny because we don't really know about them and how all that works. So that's where we ended up with that 100 Henrietta's question.
Can I ask another thing, or is it maybe too late?
No, we can do one more.
Yeah, no. All this inner work we do here brings us to, or I can tell, brings me, let's say, you know, to become more vulnerable. In our daily life, I'm not, and some of us, let's say, I'm not so used to be vulnerable 100%, let's say. I can be vulnerable with friends, you know, one-on-one dialogue. So I was wondering what are your thoughts? What do you think is the value of being vulnerable and asking help and showing also, you know, a part that it doesn't correspond to your normal role or the perception that you have? How do you imagine other people normally see you? Because you kind of break this self-image that you have. I'm sorry, the image that you think that others have.
How about you? I might talk about it a little differently because I actually think that this knowledge, say the knowledge part, and working through some of the childhood things gives you the strength that allows you to be vulnerable when you want to be, because you have the inner strength of your own, the strength of your own being, the strength of your own well-being that allows you to be vulnerable in the sense of being able to be honest about your feelings or honest about what's going on with you in the appropriate situation. You know, it has to be, the thing is, are you strong enough to be vulnerable in an appropriate situation to be vulnerable? I don't think that we're walk around as vulnerable in the same way to all people and in all circumstances. So it's only in a circumstance where that vulnerability would be appropriate and good. But the problem is you don't feel safe enough or strong enough in yourself to be vulnerable. You know, then you would want, then you can't really do that. But if you have that inner strength just because of knowing who you are really, what is really the truth of it, and you've also unloaded some of the pains and whatnot from the childhood things that we work on, that has been worked through, then you are not vulnerable in those ways anymore. I mean, you can be very honest about all of those things, but you're not vulnerable because you're fine with it. So there's nothing secret there. And then if in certain circumstances, like in working out something with your partner or with a good friend or whatever it is, you are able to be vulnerable or to be honest in that situation because you have enough strength to do that. And so I don't see being vulnerable as to have anything to do with weakness. I think it has more to do with strength. But then you have to decide where it's appropriate and when to be vulnerable or to be really honest or forthcoming, or somebody needs more from you than you're used to giving, then that's not necessarily being vulnerable. It's not natural for you to be giving in that way, in that circumstance. And then you have to decide whether you want to be able to do that or not. And maybe vulnerable is by vulnerable, does that mean opening yourself up for hurt? Because that's a way you can define vulnerable. Say, I'm being really vulnerable because you could really hurt me and misuse, abuse me because of the weakness I'm showing you or the sensitivity that I'm showing you. You could really hurt me if I make that known to you. So that's another way vulnerable could be used. And so I think you can be strong. You have to be strong enough in yourself to be vulnerable. And then the person you can handle, if the person wants to try to hurt you, it doesn't matter because you're strong enough in yourself to handle it. So vulnerable doesn't mean weakness. I would associate vulnerability more with strength and not associate it with weakness. Because if you associate it with weakness, then it's like saying, is it all right to be weak in front of people? Because they're not used to seeing me as weak. That's much different than vulnerable. And so, you know, we all are what we might label as weak or hurt in some ways, and then the people that you share that with are people who you trust can help you, can handle that, and not say, oh, I didn't know that guy was so weak. That's all such BS. And so you're not weak too. Everybody's weak at times in certain ways. But the people that can really, you share that with, are the people that really can help prop you up, give you some strength, and give you some, you know, sense of strength, not tear you down. You don't want to be with somebody who will tear you down when you're feeling weak. And you can be vulnerable when you're strong. It means strong in yourself. Does that make sense? Am I talking in circles?
Yeah. What when you underline the difference between weakness and vulnerability, can you make an example of what you refer to?
Yeah. If you're if you're vulnerable in a sensitive situation between you and another person, you're just being honest, you know, and you're not trying to lie or shield yourself or give them some story. You're just being real and honest, and you have the strength to do that, you know. And so you're making yourself vulnerable because you're not putting up some shield, which actually is just you're hiding behind. So vulnerable means that you're open to really be real and talk about something. Being when you're feeling weak, that's a different kind of vulnerability. There's no one, you're not strong enough yourself to handle that weakness. And so then it's good to have a friend or somebody, at least in the women's world, it's not a tip, you know, a friend or somebody that you can really talk to and say what's how you're feeling and what's going on. We do that for each other all the time, and I think men have a harder time to do that. If you have good male friends, and women friends, of course, but good male friends are really, really valuable. And you have somebody that can actually, a man that you can actually have as a friend and be honest about your feelings and, you know, and your hurts and all of that thing. Those male bonds are really, really great, deep, deep friendships where this lion-like persona is let down. I know men, a lot of men have that now, share with people with each other, which is how it should be. It's a great thing. Our culture is Western culture, much more than Indian culture, is creating this monstrous view of what it means to be masculine and what it means to be feminine. It just wipes out like 90% of the people because we don't fit in either one of those extremes. You know, say there's a continuum, have masculine whatever and feminine whatever. And so these are the men way over here, and these are the women over here. It's like in a normal curve. This is a normal curve. For those who know science at all, here are the outliers out here. Well, these are the men and these are the women, and then there's all of us in between. That's really ridiculous. Yeah. So the archetypes, the extreme archetypes, didn't used to be that actually, where there's so much variety, you know, in the masculine and in the feminine. Like even if you look at the Greek gods and goddesses, they're so different. You know, like there was Hera, you know, and then Aphrodite, and then there was Diana and Athena. And others. These are the Greek goddesses. And Hestia. It's just a whole different. All different expressions of the feminine and the masculine also. It's like that kind of in India, though I see the masculine and feminine much more well-rounded in terms of the expression of an individual woman or an individual man. So much of that, all of that is kind of included. Like say, here, if there's this normal curve and we are only acknowledging the outliers, in an Indian masculine and feminine, it takes up much more is included in a man and in a woman. Much more texture, much more ability to be many different things within the feminine and masculine spectrum. So it's not just these little things on the outside. You get to have a full gamut of feelings and emotions. And so it's really meaningful for me when I read the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and to see the whole spectrum of emotion and strength in both the feminine and in the masculine. I feel like you can breathe. And they were all the devatas also, and the heroes and heroines. They had the full expression of what it would mean to be a man or a woman. It's not just this little bitty thing out here. And so that's part of what we have to do as we, in our culture, as the centuries go by, or as the decades go by, we keep re-owning what it means to be a person. We're not stuck in these little tiny roles.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting book about called Power of Being Vulnerable or something like that by Brene Brown.
Yeah. What's it called?
The Power of Being Vulnerable.
That sounds like a nice title.
Yeah.
She has a nice pet talk.
Mm.
So.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you go back into pep talk is when you go back into some of these ancient Greek things that are like the Iliad and the Odyssey. These are great epics. And then go back maybe to some of the Hindu epics. You get back to kind of a more full human expression. That's really wonderful. I'm interested in that book. I'd like to take, maybe I'll look at it on Kindle or something. What's it called?
Power.
The Power of Being Vulnerable.
Yeah, I think so. At least in
something
Swedish
like that.
It's Kraften, and then Styrkan of a Sword. Brené Brown is the name of the author.
What's the first name? Brené?
Brené.
Oh.
Brené.
Brené
Brown.
Good. Now we can say our prayer.
Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishah Kobramanebhya Shubhamastu Nityam Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamsho bharahitah brahmana santu nirbhayah om sarvesham swastir bhavatu sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamasoma Jyotir Gamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om